Hello and welcome to the Full of Beans podcast, hosted by myself, Hannah Hickenbotham. Throughout these podcast episodes, we will speak to a range of individuals about their experience of eating disorders, with the aim of increasing awareness and understanding whilst reducing stigma and isolation. Please note that the topics discussed in this podcast may be triggering for some individuals, so tread lightly, check in with yourself, and reflect on these conversations. This week, I'm joined by David Coyle. David is a consultant psychiatrist and the clinical lead for adult eating disorder services across multiple trusts in Northern Ireland. With a career spanning 18 years in mental health and 7 years specialising in eating disorders, David is dedicated to his clinical work, especially where he can be creative and innovative. He is also passionate about teaching and provides training for various healthcare disciplines in the region. One of his notable interests is exploring the treatment options available for severe and enduring eating disorders. I feel absolutely honoured to have been able to sit down and have this conversation with David. Terms like severe and enduring eating disorders and the thought of palliative care can be very distressing, but listening to David's experience of supporting patients with eating disorders and when palliative care is something to be considered, it really highlighted to me how much our clinicians do care and that these decisions aren't taken lightly, but the interest of the patient is always at the heart of what clinicians do. I really hope that you enjoy this episode and it gives you a different perspective to thinking about these conditions. It's so lovely to have you, David. As I said before, it feels like so long ago since we spoke. So it's really nice to actually be recording the podcast with you now.
Yes, it is actually. Although it also feels like yesterday whenever I looked at the emails, I thought, oh my goodness, is it June already?
Yeah, well, this is the scary thing. The year is going so quickly and we've not even had a summer yet, really, which is what's concerning me.
Yeah, no, that's true.
But yeah, it's so nice to have you on the podcast. For the listeners, would you mind just introducing yourself and telling us about a little bit about what you do?
Sure, of course. So I'm David Coyle. I'm a consultant psychiatrist. And I am, gosh, I'm going to get this right. So I'm the regional clinical lead for adult eating disorder services in Northern Ireland. There's only two of us at the moment, two consultant psychiatrists in Northern Ireland working in this specialty. And I cover four of the trust areas. So
wow. Quite a lot.
Yeah.
For the listeners that cannot see my face right now, I am sure you will have the same face. I have a jaw drop. That sounds intense.
Yes, although it's all I've ever known since starting. So, I mean, The intensity was always there in that I hadn't necessarily aspired to become an eating disorder psychiatrist. I had always wanted to be a liaison psychiatrist in general wards. That's what I enjoyed most in my training. And then 2 days before I was due to qualify as a consultant, one of my senior line managers, who I would have thought of as my mummy in psychiatry, she was a psychiatrist who I always looked up to and who knew me quite well. She said, you know what, I've got the specialty for you. So 2 days later, I started, having no experience in eating disorder, as the regional clinical lead in eating disorder as a consultant. So like dumped in at the deep end.
Wow. And how did that go?
Do you know what? I'm still here 7 years later. So, actually, in a strange way, it was really helpful, because the first piece of advice that I got when I started was from Frances Conan from Vincent Square. I don't know if you've ever talked to her or met her. She's lovely, really, really lovely woman. And she said to me, do you know what? Nobody knows what they're doing. And and I thought, oh, thanks very much. That's not helpful. But actually, it was really helpful advice, because it has allowed me to come in with a kind of blank slate and no expectations, and be a bit more creative and approach it my own way. So and it has really worked, you know, and that my mentor knew me well enough to put me into this specialty.
And I think, you know, I feel like that's what we need in eating disorder treatment at the moment, is somebody coming in with that fresh slate, kind of got that creative mindset, in terms of, we have the treatments that we have approved by NICE guidelines, but they're not necessarily working for everybody. And actually to come in with fresh ideas and maybe different ways to approach things, I think that can often be quite a good mindset to have around treatment, rather than, oh, this person has X, therefore the only treatment that will work is Y, and if that doesn't work, well, what do we do now?
Well, exactly. I mean, I I haven't for a long time now met somebody that I thought, oh, this person fits really neatly into this diagnostic category. Do you know, it just doesn't happen. And I'm not a keen diagnostician anyway. I keep talking to patients about, I'm more interested in the formulation of your story and your narrative. And that might not fit into a specific diagnostic box. And I'm not going to try and squeeze it into one either, do you know?
Yeah. And this is really interesting, Damon, and I hope you don't mind me saying this, but I think there is a big rhetoric that people that are in treatment from eating disorders understand that they may not fit in a little box of that's what anorexia looks like, that's what bulimia looks like. But a lot of people, when they're going for treatment, unfortunately are feeling that if they don't fit the criteria or they're basically put into a criteria. So it's very interesting to hear you say that that's not the way that you see it as well, because I think for so much of the time when people are going for treatment, they're met with that sort of, okay, we have anorexia, therefore we almost know all about you before we even unpacked what's going on.
Well, you're right. And it is worrying when you see people be so literal and so fixated. And I don't mean people as in the patients themselves. I'm talking about everybody, professionals especially. But I will quite often say to people, look, this diagnosis has a purpose. If I give you a label, I'm giving it as an access key to a particular treatment or an onward referral to a service. Or so we have to use diagnoses in order to work the system. But at the same time, be very honest that that's what we're doing, and that my understanding of you as an individual may not be in those terms or in that framework. My understanding of you as an individual is much more complex than that. But let's just give you the diagnosis of anorexia so we can get on with CBT, because that's what's recommended. Do you know? And be open about that discussion with the patient so that they understand this is the thinking, you know.
Yeah, and I mean, I think that's such an interesting perspective I've never really thought about before, in terms of like, in order to get the treatment that you need, you do need to have the diagnosis. And I guess, you know, you mentioned it kind of briefly there, but would there be any instances or kind of what sort of things do you weigh up when you are diagnosing somebody in terms of thinking, is this diagnosis actually going to be a benefit for them, or is it going to be something that's then categorizing them in a certain way?
Interesting that you said way up. funny, one of the things that I've learned over time, and I wouldn't have necessarily known at the start, is a lot of, you can go by the feeling in the room with the person once you get to know them. And I mean, I would never, first appointment, absolutely no way, because they're anxious, you don't know them, you know, you come with preconceptions, they come with preconceptions, so I'm not going to do that until I get to know somebody a little better anyway. But you begin to learn what the interaction with the person feels like. And I always think that, I'm quite keen on the phrase no entry defense system, and that for anorexia nervosa, I quite often see that no entry defense system where there's a resistance to taking in. And it's not just about the resistance to taking in food, although that becomes the kind of symbolic representation of it, but a resistance to taking in trusting people, taking in advice, taking in information, et cetera, et cetera. And that in order to get in, you need to then become a more trusted object, and you need to be able to work therapeutically with the person so that they can begin to take in goodness and they can begin to take in the right things. And you know, once you get the experience, you know what it's like to sit in the room with somebody who has a no entry defense system and see that come up, and then know when you're igniting it and try and recognize that and reflect on that, versus then quite often with patients with bulimia nervosa, you feel like you're getting in, but actually whenever you have another appointment, everything has gone again in between times. And so I'm like, oh, so and again, I don't mean this literally, but that information and that intake has been purged in between our appointments. And so I think, right, well, we have to find a way to help you to keep it and hold it and not do that. So it just takes, it takes knowing somebody and as a person.
Yeah. And I mean, everything that you're saying, I'm like, this is brilliant. Like, everybody needs to be talking, like singing from the same hymn sheet as you, because for me, that is the thing that maybe is missing more widely in eating disorder treatment, is, you know, one, seeing the individual and their unique challenges, not necessarily just the diagnostic label that they've been given, but also taking the time to get to know that individual, to get to know the things that are impacting them, why they're experiencing the behaviors. Because I think a lot of the time it's kind of like, oh, you know, you have anorexia, therefore you need to gain weight and your issue is obviously food. But there's so much more underlying that, that it takes time. And like you say, it takes trust as well to build, to know somebody. But it's very difficult in the short space of time sometimes that is offered to people for their treatment to develop that trust or to really be able to unpack things, especially like you said, if they've got that defense system up. Whether I think it's really interesting because, And then just speaking from my personal experience here, but, you know, when I was ill, it took me so long to let anybody in because I didn't, it was kind of two sides of a coin in that I didn't want somebody to kind of come in and tell me I couldn't do it anymore or get involved because it was my only way of surviving. But equally, the eating disorder fills your head with so many lies and things like that of how that person is trying, you know, that person is not trying to help you, they are trying to do everything but. And then the more that you get into recovery, you realize actually they were on your side the whole time. Mm-hmm. And the eating disorder was the person or the thing that was kind of lying to you in the end.
Mm-hmm. Well, I quite often use, it's really interesting to hear you say that, because two things come to mind. The first that comes to mind is, well, that's only okay if you're lucky enough to get somebody who's good and who's going to pay attention and get to know you and so on and so forth and have your best interests at heart. The other one is, the analogy that I'll quite often use and use with patients is a Trojan horse analogy. So the whole point of the no entry defense system is to protect yourself from unwanted emotional kind of projections and interactions from other people. So quite often the decisions being made in your care, the advice being offered, the things being said to you are actually fundamentally based on the anxieties of the other people, whether it be your friends, your family, the professionals involved in your care. You know, they're worried about you, so they want you to eat, but actually their desire for you to eat is fundamentally based on their worry, not on your care. And therefore it's Trojan horse. So the horse comes in of their care, but actually you as the individual who's suffering and who has that defense system goes, hang on a minute, there's a whole load of anxiety hidden inside this horse and I don't want any of that. Excuse my French, but, you know, I don't want any of that. So therefore, I would like you to stop and I want you to stay out and stay away from me. Does that make sense?
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. I think that when you've been bombarded at home, maybe beforehand, with the worry and the concern for you to eat, the last thing you then want is to add another person to that list that's going to, you know, worry and pester and force you to do things that frankly are your worst nightmare. I always think that, you know, when you're working with a patient, whether it's somebody that has bulimia, anorexia, binge eating disorder, you know, you're asking them to fundamentally at the start to eat regularly. And that's everything that they're trying to avoid because of the fear that they've placed on that and what they think is going to happen, or, you know, why they're not allowing themselves to do that. You're then saying, okay, well, that's what we need you to do first.
Yeah. Which is, and it's true. But at least, at least if you can acknowledge the reality of, you know, that this is a very simple solution, but it's the hardest thing in the world. Do you know?
Yeah. It's so funny because it does go back to that whole just eat. Like, you know, when people will say to you, well, why don't you just eat? And it's like, yes, fundamentally, that's kind of what needs to happen. But there's that whole, you know, there's so much more to it than that. But yeah.
Yeah, because quite often people will say, oh, such and such told me to just eat. And I'm like, well, are they wrong? Because, you know. but they're maybe a little misguided in the way that they're putting it across. You know, but actually, and that's the fundament, and I say this all the time, I'm like, look, we can do all sorts here, but recovery is not possible without weight restoration. Done. And that's a fundamental inescapable truth in a way, you know, unfortunately, that it's, we can certainly help you with your emotional regulation and we can help you with your occupational rehab and we can help you with your relationships within your family and et cetera, et cetera. And I can give you multivitamins and I can give you antidepressants and I can do all of these things. But unless you're weight restored, you're not going to be recovered, you know.
Yeah, I think It's so funny that you say the thing about like Just Eat, because actually I had a therapy session myself last week and I'm getting to a very good place in my recovery, but there's still a few things that, you know, need ironing out and that I want to do. And I said to my therapist, you know, there's just a few foods that, well, I say few, there's quite a lot of foods that still don't feel very comfortable. And you know, I really want to spend this session talking through it because I want to be able to eat them. And she was like, well, it's going to be a quick session on Hannah because you just need to eat them and you just need to get used to eating them. And I was like, what? that's not fair. I want to talk about the emotions. And she was like, ultimately, you've just got to practice eating them and over time it'll become easier. And I was just like, I hate the fact that that's so true because I don't want to do that.
But you could only have that conversation because you know that she knows how hard you find it.
Yeah, and also I think the trust and the relationship that we've built, she knew that I just need an honest answer rather than, you know, skirting around things and then come into that. She knew that she could say that to me and that actually I'd be like, oh, fuck's sake, you are right. and it is the truth. It's just sometimes a little bit hard to come by.
Yeah, it is. It is. It's hard to say. It's hard to hear. But that's I think actually it has taken me time to learn that recovery isn't possible without weight restoration, and yet so many things are possible but not full recovery. And so at least if we start with that premise, let's see if that's a mutually agreed goal, is full recovery or whatever that looks like for you personally. But if it's a partial weight restoration, then we're not looking at full recovery, we're having a different conversation, you know. So
yeah, and I think that's the difficult thing to admit, because I guess you can say one thing is guaranteed is weight recovery or weight restoration, but there's no guarantee of what that number is going to be. And I think that's where the fear comes in, because I mean, you know, again, speaking from an anecdotal perspective, I knew that I needed to gain weight because I wasn't at a weight that was healthy for me. But it's then like, well, what is that weight? And what happens when I reach the weight that I feel comfortable, or, you know, as the number keeps going up? And it's having that trust in the process and knowing that it's going to be okay, but also knowing that that number could be higher than what it was before. It could be lower, it could be the same. There's just no knowing of where your body now needs to get to.
Yeah, it is. It's really tough, and a journey that's so individual to everybody, you know, and there's no predicting it. You can look at your family, but that doesn't tell you everything that you need to know. And I always think, I think about the inner cave woman or inner cave man, you know, that you know, I'm quite a fan of kind of evolutionary psychology and biology, and thinking about, well, we are pre-programmed that if we're hungry, well, then we get adrenaline and we get filled with neurotransmitters because we have to go out and hunt or gather. You know, your body is literally telling you go and kill the wildebeest because you're hungry. And that when you are sated, then that will all calm down, because from an evolutionary perspective, you're being told, okay, now you can go and decorate your cave and you can do some finger painting and you can do those other things. And so you have to learn to trust your inner barometer, like, oh, hang on a minute, I'm no longer getting those signals. But that's hard to do when your signals are all messed up. Do you know? So you have to also learn how to read your signals accurately. And if you've had trauma, then your signals might be primed to be too acute. And it's so complicated, you know?
Yeah. And I think that's the other thing, that other element. I mean, all of it comes down to trust, really, I think, is being able to, you know, like you said, you might not be aware of those signals or know what they feel like or things like that. And then it's also being able to trust, okay, my body's saying I'm hungry now, so that means it's hungry, or I trust that I'm now full and I don't need to eat anymore and things like that. And I think, you know, part of one thing with an eating disorder is you rely on the eating disorder so much because you lose all that trust within your body. So then having to regain that in such a scary situation anyway, it's a lot. Like, it's completely possible, but it definitely is a hard process to go through.
It is very difficult to move. It's kind of like a hostage situation, like Stockholm syndrome to an eating disorder, you know. I know this, even though this is a very abusive relationship, I know it at least, so I'm going to stay here. Do you know? What alternative are you offering me? I'm offering you the unknown. Oh, well, I don't know if I want that.
Yeah, literally. But I always say, and this is basically what I said to myself, was, okay, let's have a look at the people that we know in our life that have recovered. And the reviews are pretty good. You know, most people, well, all people, I would say, that have recovered have wanted to stay in their recovered position. But worst case scenario, if you seem to be the odd one out in recovery, is not good for you, and, you know, it feels awful, you can always come back to the known, and you can come back to the eating disorder. And, you know, I think that was, for me, was a nice thing to have in the back of mind, is, okay, that's unknown, but this known here is quite bad, and potentially that unknown could be worse, but potentially that unknown could be so much better, so we might as well give it a shot.
Yeah, it's a good way of looking at it. It depends how long you're willing to sit with the unknown to decide whether if it's okay or not.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's the other thing, isn't it? Because that, for me, I'm fortunately out of that kind of horrific, everything's awful, why am I doing recovery? I'm seeing the benefits now. And, you know, I'm trying to shout about them from the rooftop, so that if people are in that sort of, and whether this is working or not, then to see that hope. But that kind of, I guess, reminds me of something that I did want to talk to you about, which is severe and enduring eating disorders, because I know that you've done quite a lot of work on that. And I think that sometimes there's a little bit of misunderstanding about SEED, if we're going to kind of use the acronym. So would you be able to give us a bit of an explanation of what that means?
Yes, although now it feels like in the kind of public discourse that if you put your head above the parapet and use the term SEED or that you're going to get your head blown off. But then I'm not afraid of things like that. I'm just going to say it anyway. So I it's not a diagnosis. It's a descriptor. And I often think to myself, well, it does exactly what it says on the tin. Your symptoms are severe and it has been enduring. It has been around for a long time, do you know? So, but it's the fear, again, a bit like what I said at the start, it's the fear of if this is being treated like a diagnostic label that's going to lump me into a particular box. And then what is that box going to look like? And what am I going to be offered? And so quite often the discourse around SEED automatically veers towards treatment withdrawal, terminal care, palliative care, all of those kind of scary topics. It goes in that direction because people are terrified of the box, you know, and what's in there. But actually, different people around the country, and including I have a SEED clinic in my own service, and I do not see it that way at all. If anything, it's a leaning into care. It's more input. It's trying to be creative. It's trying to vary up what you do. It's trying to work with the person on more personalized care plans and a more bespoke sort of recovery picture. It's always telling them, look, I would prefer you to recover. I would prefer you to be weight restored. That's what I would like. But you're telling me right now that that's impossible for you. So let's do our best with where we're at. And let's see if I can keep poking and prodding and trying different things, then maybe eventually you'll change your mind and you'll head in that direction. And we've seen it happen. You know, we've seen it happen with individuals who've been at, you know, really dangerously low weights for long, long periods, that we've stopped detaining and we've stopped forcing them and we've stopped doing that. We're trying to work in a more creative way and in a more collaborative way, who've then gone on to weight restore and have moved towards recovery, you know, and that actually what was missing the whole time was just backing off a little bit and just being present. And quite often I'll say that sometimes SEED is, and I mean this in as clinical way as possible, that it's therapeutic doing nothing. So it's kind of, I'm going to hold this position of health and I'm going to be present and I'm going to be available to the person, but I'm not going to constantly try and intervene, because something about my constant intervention is actually not helping you, and therefore I should stop. And so I, you know, see them all regularly and we chat and we think about what else could we try, but I'm not going to force you, you know. And that's what it means to me, is not making somebody do something that's on your agenda rather than theirs.
I think, I have so many questions. I'm going to try and just take a deep breath to try and vocalize what I'm trying to say. It's really interesting to hear your perspective of it. Because I think, like you said, you know, nowadays when you mention the term seed, there is a lot of like, oh my God, I can't believe that you're kind of, you know, labeling somebody with that. It's so terminal and things like that. But actually, from your perspective, it's more backing off a little bit, maybe giving some people a bit of breathing space. And I guess with that, I wonder, from your perspective, how you sort of judge when the right time to do that is. Because if you're suggesting that, then I guess your argument could be to that, well, then why do you ever detain somebody if you don't think that that's going to be, you know, if that's not supportive, if people then go on to recover after you backing off a bit?
Brilliant question, and it is the key question in all of this, so I'm glad that you got straight to it. And I don't have a concrete answer. I wish I did, because of, you know, that would make my job a lot easier. And I do get asked that a lot. I get asked, right, when do we do it, when do we not? And I think a lot of it does come down to knowing the person really well. So you need to have a good relationship with the individual, even if it's a fractious one. But it needs to be a solid one. And then it's a case of thinking about, well, have we absolutely scraped the barrel here? Have we tried everything? Has the person lost the run of themselves or not? Do you know, are they able to articulate and think their way through this clearly? Or have they lost that degree of rationality and have they gone off the edge? And so quite often I'm looking for signs of starvation. You know, am I looking for that the person's actual way of looking at the world themselves and thinking has been warped by hunger and warped by starvation, and therefore we need to lift them out of that to give them the best chance possible to make better decisions? But that can vary. So you can't gauge it by BMI. You can't gauge it by number of years. I think all of that's nonsense, because I've seen patients who, maybe after 14, 15 years, something shifts and something changes. Equally, I see people that I've, you know, only known for 1 or 2 years, and I think I have that worry in my head thinking, I'm not sure if something is going to shift here. They seem so fixated. And we just have to give it time and patience. So I think detaining wise, I'm much more inclined to go down that more forceful route if I think they're starved, they're new, they haven't tried, they haven't made good decisions, and I need to give them the best chance to do that possible. And I'm hoping that after a bit of refeeding in hospital, they're going to go, oh my goodness, what was I thinking? Whereas if I know them well and they've already done that multiple times and they've thought, look, I haven't changed my mind, why are you still doing this to me? Then we need to have a different conversation.
No, I think that's a really like nice way to put it, in terms of you've tried everything so much and it hasn't worked, so you do need to start maybe thinking about something different. And I guess where my mind then goes, and this is another controversial topic at the moment, and you could briefly mentioned it, is the idea of palliative care. In that, so maybe we're in this situation where you know someone really well, nothing's been working, rather than you backing off and kind of giving them some space to breathe, obviously still providing that support that they need to keep them in a stable position, they're asking for palliative care, or I don't know whether they're asking for palliative care, or maybe your suggestion is palliative care. What would be the difference there?
So I have had two patients in the last 7 years, both enter into a palliative care pathway, and well, actually I have had four who have had involvement of palliative care, but two have gone on to stabilize and do okay and have been withdrawn from palliative care, and two unfortunately went on to die whilst on palliative care pathway. And I have to say, particularly for the last case, it was probably the most intensive input I've had with a case in my career. You know, I was seeing her at home sometimes twice a week, and she was seeing OTs and she was seeing dietitians, and the palliative care team were out to see her, the GP was out to see her, I had separate appointments with her family to offer them support. You know, it was really intensive. And so I quite often, whenever, having been through that process with her and her family, I resent when quite often palliative care is characterized as a withdrawal and a giving up and a backing away, because that's not how it felt. It actually felt like a real leaning in, do you know, and this really intimate, you know, process. And I remember being at her funeral and actually people coming up to me and saying, you know, thank you, you tried really hard and you were the clinician. I wanted to throw myself out a window. I couldn't bear people saying that because I felt like a failure. You know, I was like, no, my goal as a doctor is to fix people. So the fact that she has not been well is tragic and awful to me. And yet it felt dignified, and I genuinely couldn't think of anything else to do, nor could she, nor could her family, and everything felt like torture. So it was just, and it's a, such a small number of cases, it's so individualized. I knew her really, really, really well, so we were able to have those conversations about what else should we do and what should we try. And the only difference was that I stopped detaining her. That was literally the only difference. Or stopped asking for her detention. Everything else, actually, there was more and more intense. So it's whether we force someone or whether we don't is actually what the fundamental question to me ends up being. Because for some people, when we stop forcing them, they get better. And for a very small percentage, when we stop forcing them, they have no parachute. And, you know, the alternative might be death. And I don't know if that answers your question, because it's a very, very difficult question to answer, and it's really emotive, and I have to say it's emotive for everybody as a society. It's really emotive for me as the clinician that was looking after her. Do you know, I still have her thank you card sitting on my desk, you know, and I just, you know, it really, really affected me at the time. I was really close to her family, really close to her. So the whole thing was horrendous, but it was very thoughtful. If that, you know, we put a lot of effort and a lot of thought into it.
Yeah. Well, David, I just want to say I'm so grateful for you sharing that, because I think there's a lot of talk about palliative care within the eating disorder community at the moment, and you sharing your experience there, I think, shows the fundamental message, like you said, that as a doctor, your only goal for people is to look after them and to get them well. And so for you to not be able to achieve that, no, I can completely understand why you did feel like that you weren't kind of doing your job. But, you know, from the way that you spoke so emotively about that, it shows just how much you care. And I wanted to ask the question, because you said that you had, I think, a couple of patients that went on palliative care and they survived, and then a couple that didn't. So it's not necessarily always end of life treatment that people can go on to recover, because I think that's the sort of whatever the word would be, rhetoric that we're hearing at the moment is,
yeah.
I think, like you said, it's almost giving up care. Mm-hmm. But actually, from what you're saying, it sounds very different to that.
Well, I found the working with my colleagues in palliative care was really, really helpful. They were really kind, lovely, containing people. I actually then did training with them. Like, we did mutual training. I trained their staff in eating disorder, and they came and talked to us about palliative care. And their take on it was, I don't understand why we haven't heard from you before. Do you know, why haven't we had these conversations before? And actually them coming and doing an assessment and meeting the person and meeting their family just gave a more holistic sense of the overall picture. And it was more about informed consent in a way. It was like, look, this is what death might look like, and this is what the options might be, and the reality of it. And for those who have then gone on to say, oh, no, that's not what I want, it really helped, because then they thought, oh, actually, if that's what it looks like, no, thank you, I don't want that. So I would like to recover. Whereas for the two who didn't, having those conversations meant, oh, do you know what? Actually, I think I can't. That means that people are supporting me and that I feel cared for, and that doesn't make me feel as tortured. And so maybe I do want to have those conversations, and I do want to think about that, you know. So, but it was being done with somebody who, that was their profession, that was their job, that was their expertise, rather than me, who hold my hands up and say, I'm not a palliative care consultant, and therefore all I'm doing is asking a colleague to take a look at this and give me their thoughts.
And so what you're saying is as well that it's the patient has complete kind of final decision on whether that's something that they want to. It's not you saying, okay, we've tried everything, so we're going to put you on palliative care. It's, this is an option to explore. Would yes. you like to go down this route?
And actually, one of the things that I would have said to my patients when I was out seeing her at home, and to the point where she used to laugh and say, oh, would you give over, was, would you stop saying to me, you know, you can change your mind. You know, I can still bring you into hospital. You know, we can still refeed you. I'll NG, I'll peg, I'll do whatever. Like, absolutely. Even days before, I mean, she died on a Thursday. I saw her on a Tuesday was the last time that I saw her at home. And she was really, really weak. And I said to her, look, I don't know if it'll work, but I'll still do it. I'll still take you in. You can change your mind. You do not have to go through with this. And she's like, no, I know. Thank you for asking, but no, leave me alone. So, yeah. I always need the person to know this is not my choice. This is not, I'll support you, but actually I would prefer you to recover. I would prefer you to do well. But that's my vision of what recovery looks like. And I can't impose that on somebody else.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think, you know, hearing you share that and kind of the fact that the patient has such an informed choice there, I think is so important. But I guess one question that I do have is often, like from my understanding, when clinicians will detain somebody under the Mental Health Act, it's because they don't have capacity to be making decisions for themselves. So in that place, when somebody is saying, yes, I think palliative care is right for me, are they actually in a place where they're that starved to make a decision with capacity?
Again, great. Honestly, like, you're so astute. Genuinely really astute, because I have these conversations with professionals and they don't get to those questions as quickly as you have. So you're really on the money. And again, not one that is easy to answer, or that that I'm going to profess to know the answers to. I suppose capacity is very, I having wanted to be a liaison psychiatrist, the concept of assessing capacity is something that I was fascinated by and really, you know, really keen on. I don't think it's easy to do. I don't think it's cut and dry. It's not a passport. It's not like, right, you have capacity for all. It has to be very, very specific. It has to be contemporaneous, constantly reassessed. And you have to know the person well. You need to know what their pre-morbid decisions would have been. You need to see them at their best, see them at their worst, you know. And I suppose I don't think capacity is weight related. I don't think you can be as concrete as that. A lot of people say, oh, no, you've got a BMI of whatever. You definitely can't possibly have capacity. I think that's a nonsense. You know, I think you need to, again, know, because each individual is slightly different. I've seen patients who lack capacity at BMIs of 22, 23. And I've seen patients who I believe have capacity at BMIs of 13 and 14. It just depends. And I'll give you an example. That somebody saying to me, and this is almost a direct quote, look, when I am starved, I feel a bit numb. I don't really feel my emotions as intensely. When I refeed and whenever I'm a healthier weight, all of my past experiences kind of come tumbling back into my head and I feel really distressed by them, and I have lots of flashbacks and lots of, and I've had therapy till it's coming out my ears and it hasn't made that go away. And therefore, I would rather be numb and I would rather be starved than have all of those feelings. And I know that I might die as a result of that, but I would still rather choose that than all of that distress. And if somebody can really articulate that and think that through, I'm like, well, that's capacity. You understand. Now, the little chink in the armor there is, I've had therapy until it's coming out my ears. So what therapy have you had? How good a quality of a therapy was it? What were, you know, did you get the best chance to maximize your capacity at that point? Now, in that example, the person did. I mean, they had literally done about 8 different therapies with good therapists. So, you know, they really tried. But some people, in her case, some people's trauma is just too difficult. Now, I stopped detaining her. She's now a normal body weight and has a job and has a partner. So, you know, she, when people stopped forcing her and they stopped with their Trojan horses, she was able to tolerate restoring weight.
Wow. That's incredible. Wow. I don't know what to say, because it's so incredible hearing stories like that, especially, you know, when clinicians really have just held that beacon of hope and explored the different options with people. But I think also it gives so much hope to people that maybe have been struggling for such a long time and feel like all their options have been explored. And I know that this always sounds so, it's kind of like the just eat it phrase, like, you know, you have to want to recover yourself. But I think, unfortunately, that is the reality, that you can try every single therapy in the book, but until something clicks with you, recovery won't be something that will necessarily happen. And my personal experience has been exactly that. I've been in and out of services for 14 years. And September this year, I couldn't tell you what happened because I have no idea, but something clicked. And it wasn't like an overnight, oh, I'm better now, which I think is what some people expect. But it was just, I think I might try something different here. And then trying something a little bit different, you know, felt a bit uncomfortable, but the more I did it, the less uncomfortable it felt. And then kind of now looking back, I'm like, wow, I don't really know where the last 9 months have gone, but something's changed. And that can be so difficult when you're in the depths of it all and someone's just saying to you, well, something just has to click. Now, when's it going to freaking click? but equally, I think, you know, I completely think that there's a time and a place for where massive input is required in order to support somebody. But on the same side, I think, like you said, when a lot of things have been explored, sometimes it is just a case of almost not leaving somebody to it, but just letting them kind of figure it out a little bit, rather than that constant bombardment of these are all the things that you need to.
Well, it might be the one thing that hasn't been tried, you know. Yeah. So, and it's not, again, it's so important to make that distinction between it's not a withdrawal. And I mean, I'm saying that there are obviously a select number of people where actually you do need to withdraw completely because your input is maybe making them worse. Mm. But that's a small number. It's still a being present. And I think the way that you describe it is so good, that kind of click, or I would talk about the pivot, you know, that kind of point where the person just tilts like a seesaw in the other direction. But our job as professionals, and I'm going to proviso that, but I'll come back to it. But our job is to get them to that pivot. And so, but that journey is unknown. So it's like, which therapy is going to get them there? Or is it four therapies? Or is it five therapies? Is it a dietitian? Is it an OT? Is it art? Is it like, what is going to get them to that pivot? Mm-hmm. That's our job, to try and work it out with them. And the proviso is, it's not just us. There's a whole solar system around this person. There's the society that they're in. There's the church that they're in. There's the street that they live on. There's their family. There's their partner. There's their children, do you know? And everybody in the solar system will maybe need to pivot and make some change if this person's going to recover. Because I say to my patients all the time, you are not the only problem. Do you know, I'm a problem. Your therapist is a problem. Your mum's a problem. Your sister's a problem. You know, so we all need to sort our problems out if you're going to have any chance of sorting yours out. And the sad cases and the ones that frustrate me endlessly are those who I see all these points in their systems and in their solar systems that won't change and won't flex. And I think, well, what chance do they have if no one's willing to do that?
Yeah. You know? Yeah, and I think if you've not got that support around you, it can feel even more difficult to, I guess, know what you're recovering for. But I guess one thing that I also wanted to say there, that has been my experience, is obviously the people around you can be an issue in the way that they are. And sometimes you can just say, I'm going to cut you out. Unfortunately, there has been family members that I've had to do that with, because for me, they just weren't beneficial to my recovery. But equally, for the ones that maybe weren't that drastic, it was also, I guess my point is basically, and I always use this example of, I could go into a shop tomorrow and choose a sandwich, and somebody next to me could say, oh, I'm not going to have that sandwich because I'm on a diet. Just a random stranger. I can't control what that person said. I have to control my reaction to it. And so I spent a lot of time kind of trying to say to people, oh, please, can you do this a different way? Or can you say this a different way? And in some aspects, you know, when there were big things that were really upsetting me, that was a good conversation to have rather than me kind of internalizing that. But equally, you know, you can't control what everybody says. And often it's about reframing your response or the way that it impacts you as well to, in order to support your recovery. Because yes, I can say to my mum, please don't talk about your latest diet. But sometimes you're in situations where that's not really appropriate to say. And so it's definitely about adjusting the way that you respond to things, as well as kind of hoping that the people closest to you will support that decision as well.
Absolutely, yeah, because you're always going to have that nanny in the corner who says, gosh, you've filled out, look at your cheeks. Do you know, you're going to have that person,
yeah,
because that's their, and I'm thinking here, obviously, I live in Ireland, so that's the traditional Irish granny sitting in the corner, always commenting on people's weight, do you know?
Yeah.
But some people in the system have the capacity to change, and it's when they can and won't that I start to get really frustrated, you know. And as you say, maybe cutting out is, but you can't cut some people out, you know. So now that, and that's why I know we haven't really got the opportunity too much to talk about it, but that's one of the things, or one of the reasons that we provide mentalization treatment for carers as well within our service. So we will take in people's mums and dads and partners and do the same therapy with them as what we're offering the individual who's suffering, so that the mentalizing culture and the way that people relate to one another is changing within the entire system, rather than necessarily just with the person themselves and us as staff, because we are the co-facilitators and we're there getting our supervision. And I'll say, look, this is me too, you know, I come with my Trojan horse anxieties, and I may make the wrong thing, decisions, or say the wrong thing to you, and I have to take ownership of that, and I want you to call me out when I do it, do you know. So that we can have that kind of conversation, I think, is really important.
Definitely, yeah. And I was actually going to say, because we've had such a brilliant chat and not had the time for mentalization, I was going to ask you if you wanted to come back for a part two. So I'm glad that you brought that up. But I think, I honestly think that that, and again, I'm talking from a personal perspective, but I think that the matter of parents or the people around you sort of understanding what's going on or getting their own therapy or things like that, that's been two massive things in my recovery. Was one, my mum attended a BEAT training, like a 6-week course, and she was able to understand so much more and talk to other people and get support for it as well. That transformed my recovery. I mean, I don't live at home, but just to have her on the other end of the phone understanding. And the other thing was my partner going to therapy, and not necessarily him talking about me every time, but him having a space to talk about his own issues and the things that were going on in his life, because at home at the time there wasn't really that space to do that. And that was a big motivator for me, was to get to a point where we had that shared, you know, I could listen to his concerns, he could listen to mine, rather than it always being about me. But I think being able to just be honest and be, you know, oh, I don't really understand why that's happened. Or, you know, as a clinician, you know, I messed up there. I didn't really do the right thing. We're all human at the end of the day. And it goes back to what you said at the start. Like, nobody knows what they're doing. Like, you've worked with an eating disorder patient before, but you've never worked with the eating disorder patient that you're sat with there in that moment right then. So one thing that worked last week could have been absolutely brilliant or absolutely shite. This week it could be perfect or be awful. So I think it's just, it's having that awareness that eating disorders change so much. They just do anything to continue to exist. But the more people that we have on the side working together against the eating disorder, the better, because ultimately if it's just the eating disorder and then your whole army of coping mechanisms and people and different things that you can do, it's going to be a whole lot better.
Yeah, well, it makes me think of that line. I don't know if it's probably not in common parlance, or whether it's just me, that you know, eating disorder is a terrorist and I don't negotiate with terrorists.
Brilliant.
I'll negotiate with you, but I'm not negotiating with a terrorist.
I love that. That's so funny. That is, that could even be the title.
but you know, it's interesting, actually. I suppose it's a good opportunity, because one of the things, and I've had it thrown at me obviously multiple times as well, is that whenever you start to have that conversation about the solar system around the person, and quite often you're talking about family, and quite often you're talking about parents, because let's face it, the vast majority of the patients that I have, their primary support mechanism is their, well, usually their mother actually, but you know, both parents in some cases. And I And people will then say, oh, this is very carer blaming or this is very parent blaming. And I've heard that, you know, obviously in conversations with patients and their families, but also heard it at quite high up levels, you know, in the faculty and so on, where people will say, that's what you're saying. And it's absolutely not. I'm trying to understand the entire complex picture of why this person has landed at where they've landed, of which you are a component. You know, you are an active part of their life. So therefore, everything needs examined to work out, how do we fix it? How do we tweak it? How do we make it better? And I always say to people, look, I don't blame you. However, if we're having this conversation now and we're working out what works and what doesn't, and it's a collaborative thing that we're working with this person, and we've worked out something that doesn't work and you're still doing it, now I'm going to blame you. because before this you didn't know and you meant your best, and that's great, but now that you've got a different perspective and we're working on it in a different way, the onus of responsibility lies on everybody to try and make some change, you know, and alleviate the weight, that kind of weight that patients carry. I'm like, it doesn't all belong to them. Can somebody else, can you all take your own luggage and carry it for them? Do you know?
Yeah, absolutely. I think that's a really good point. You know, if it's completely understandable, maybe if you're doing something that you don't realise is impacting somebody, but as soon as they then said, you know, this is actually really impacting me, can we change this or can we talk about it or whatever? If nobody then changes, it's kind of, yeah, then I think you can start to point the finger. But David, it's been honestly such a pleasure. I don't know where that 55 minutes has gone. I mean, please, I want to organise another episode with you because I do want to talk about mentalisation-based therapy as well. But yeah, thank you so much. And I really do appreciate you sharing the experiences that you've had, because I think sometimes clinicians can hold things back a little bit and maybe not be as humanistic as you have been. So it is really important, I think, to show that you guys are just human and you are out here literally just trying to do your best. Well, you are doing your best.
Thank you. I some days I feel that way. Other days I think, oh, should have done that better or should have done that different. But I need to do that, you know. And thank you, because this is not how I expected this conversation to go. And yet it afforded the opportunity to have some really interesting, important conversations. And because you asked such good questions, you know, you obviously are really thoughtful about that and went straight to the, you know, made a beeline for the important questions. So I appreciate you doing that.
If you enjoyed listening today, you won't want to miss next week's episode. So be sure to subscribe. Eating disorders are crippling illnesses, but with the right support, they can be recovered from. We really hope you enjoyed this episode, but if you require more support right now, please look into charities such as First Steps and Beat for support, or talk to someone you trust.